Hey guys, welcome to the PowerPoint presentation for Chapter 6. My name is Eddie Lester, the founder and CEO of Fitness Mentors, and we are back. We are back to go over Chapter 6 and start on the subject of integrated training and learning a little bit more about what NASM thinks about integrated training, including their OPT model and some of the ways that they encourage training your clients. So, let's go ahead and start on slide 2. And specifically, we're going to go over, so what is integrated training? So integrated training means basically combining several or all of the components of training that are necessary to help a client obtain optimum performance, or basically help them to achieve a fitness goal. And that's integrated training just refers to, there's lots of different types of modalities to getting someone towards a fitness goal. But integrated training, it takes, we'll say, bits and pieces from each modality to make sure that you have a complete training program. And the first kind of one we're gonna talk about, or like an intro to this, is how does the body adapt to stress? And the way that NASM is going to answer that question is going to be by using the General Adaptation Syndrome, sometimes known as GAS or GAS. So the general adaptation syndrome is basically going to describe how your body is going to adapt to the stresses that are placed on it over time. And so basically, you want to achieve a fitness goal. What is going to happen as on your way to achieving that fitness goal? So the first part of the general adaptation syndrome is going to be the alarm reaction. And the alarm reaction is basically going to be the initial response, or the initial reaction to the stressor. So the initial response to a stressor would be something like you started a workout, and in that workout your muscles are, you're breathing heavily, and your body has to supply more O2 or more O2 to your muscles that are working. Okay, I also consider the alarm reaction kind of that initial period in which you become really, really sore after working out for like one workout, in the sense that your body's not used to the stress that you're placing on it. Therefore, you get pretty dang sore, meaning you're more sore than you would be, further down the road, because you're not used to that type of training. Kind of like an alarm's going off saying, "Hey, I wasn't used to that. I'm really sore," and you have a physiological response that indicates a repair for all those damaged tissues. So that alarm reaction is the beginning stage. I also like to say the alarm reaction is typically the first week of a training program, maybe the first 1 to 2 weeks of the training program. But yeah, that's that initial response where you get really sore and your body has to work harder because it's not used to the stress that you're placing on it. All right, after the alarm reaction, your body starts to develop an adaptation. The way that the general adaptation syndrome is going to describe that is called resistance development. Okay, so the resistance development is basically, to define it, it's the increased capacity to adapt to a stressor, meaning that you have worked out a 5-rep program that's pretty heavy for 2 weeks in a row, and on the third week, there's a noticeable increase in strength gains, and you are doing significantly heavier weight than you were on weeks 1 and 2, we'll say. Or basically, you're increasing the motor unit recruitment, allowing yourself to push more weight. It is basically saying that you have adapted to the stressor, or have began the adaptation to the stressor that you're looking for. So if it's strength and you begin a strength program, the week in which you start to notice that there's noticeable strength gains, which is typically anywhere from weeks 3 to weeks 4, or even sometimes week 2, that is considered the resistance development. So a fitness program typically lasts anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, according to NASM. The first 2 weeks are going to be the alarm reaction. Then the second 2 to 3 weeks, you're going to be noticing the resistance development. And you've definitely increased your ability to respond to the stimulus or adapt to that stressor. And then the third phase, as we move over to slide 3, is going to be exhaustion. So exhaustion typically occurs anywhere from like the 7th to 8th week of a program, in which your body's already adapted to the stressor, and therefore you keep hitting it with the same stressor, and your body just kind of doesn't like it. That's the best way I'd describe it, because you start to fatigue easier, your body's kind of used to it, you don't really get sore from it, but you continually do the same sort of workout, which can lead to fatigue, injury, or breakdown of specific movements that you're doing in which you aren't as strong. So the three phases, once again, are going to be the alarm reaction, the resistance development, and exhaustion. The exhaustion, once again, kind of occurs after that sixth week when you just continually do the same repetitive workout over and over and over and over. Also, in running, you typically see this a lot, is which people start to get joint pain or knee pain or hip pain or foot pain from their running too much or doing the same type of running too many weeks in a row without integrating, we'll say, some flexibility or other areas of training that could assist. So there's a little picture there for you to kind of show you what's happening. The resistance to the stress is on the Y axis. Time is on the X axis. And so your resistance to stress starts, and then as soon as you have that workout immediately, your body freaks out, and that little dip on slide three there in that yellow portion, that little dip is the alarm reaction. Your body's like, holy crap, and it breaks down the muscle tissue kind of significantly, and you get really, really sore. But as you move through that first week of training and you move into that second week of training, you start to recognize some minor gains or adaptations to that sort of stressor, and you become better than you were before you started the program. Then, as you get into the resistance phase, you peak. There's a peak in strength, or there's a peak in gains, or there's a peak in adaptation from that specific fitness program. So typically the goal is that once you're in the resistance phase and you hit that peak, you want to change up your workout routine. This is where periodization comes from. Because you're adapting to the stressor and you hit maximal adaptation. That's somewhere around that 4 to 6 week time period. And you don't want to continue doing that same program. Otherwise, you just kind of fall off and you no longer see benefits from that program. The moment you notice a decrease in strength, you want to switch up your workout program, or a decrease in any sort of capacity, like you're running and you can't run as long, or you get tired at a shorter mile mark, something like that. You want to switch up your training program, switch up your running program to maybe a shorter time shorter distance over a shorter time, or push it in another way, or take a week off, things like that. That's more from cardiorespiratory, but strength and working out with weights, you typically want to hit that fourth week. Maximize your adaptation, and then switch up your training program. The cool thing about this little chart right here is that at that peak, as opposed to going back down because you're doing the same whole fitness program, what will happen is that resistance will level off for about a week. And then if you hit another good alarm reaction, you get a dip and then an increase further than what you see in that brown portion right there. So you're continually increasing further, periodizing your workouts appropriately to always be responding positively to that stress. All right, so that took a little bit of time to explain, but let's go ahead and move over to slide number four. So slide number four, we're going to get into a lot of principles around exercise and working out, and specifically we're going to talk about the SED principle. And just to define the SED principle, on the bottom of this slide, slide number four, it says the specific adaptation to imposed demands. It's basically saying that whatever stress that you place on your body will basically, that's what you're going to adapt to. So to read that very specifically, the type of exercise stimulus placed on the body will determine the expected physiological outcome, meaning that if you train your biceps in the three rep range for strength, you are going to get stronger in your biceps at that rep range. Okay, so it's basically just saying that whatever you do is what you're adapting to. That's true with all sports. That's true with all, even you sitting in your chair. Let's say you sit in your chair for too long, you're adapting to that position. It's basically just whatever demands you're imposing on your body, you're going to adapt to. All right, and then the overtraining syndrome, that kind of goes along with the exhaustion from above, but overtraining syndrome is just saying that you're doing too much too frequently without taking a break. Most of the time, overtraining occurs a lot of times in running, in which you start to notice injury, and you're just pushing yourself too much too often, like 5-6 days a week of 10 miles a day. People get crazy, and all of a sudden, you start to notice minor pains. Um, or Or the guy in the gym that's working out all the time and eventually ends up with a bad posture because they've overtrained a certain muscle group and that's causing pain and that results in fatigue. And another way to describe overtraining is if you aren't sleeping, you're exercising too much, you're going to allow for a cortisol response, which then breaks down muscle and increases fat, and it's just not good. So overtraining is just working out too much without enough rest. My typical recommendation for people is 3 to 4 days per week of weightlifting, resting at least 1 to 2 full days per week, and then cardio maybe 2 to 3 days per week, depending on your goals, obviously. All right, but you need a full day of recovery and rest, whatever that may look like to you. Get a massage or just relax, sunbathe, anything like that. Just drink a lot of water, relax, low stress, that sort of thing. All right, so let's move over to slide 5, in which we continue with some of the principles, including the... So we're going to be going over mechanical specificity, neuromuscular specificity, and metabolic specificity. Okay, so these are going to be important because it's basically talking about the ways that you're working out and how those affect the body. So a mechanical specificity, to read it directly from slide 5, the weights and movements placed on the body and specific requirements to perform those movements. So... very specifically, the way that I describe mechanical specificity is the difference between doing a bench press compared to a dumbbell bench press. Those require different mechanical movements, therefore they're placing a specific mechanical stress on the body. Barbell bench press and dumbbell bench press are not the same movement. They're not the same exercise, and that is going to have different effects on the body. Not much, because you're both training chest, but the mechanics behind the motions are slightly different. The barbell, your hands stay in the same fixed position on the bar. Dumbbells, your hands can move, we'll say, medially and laterally. So it's basically just a difference there. So then the next one we have is neuromuscular specificity. Neuromuscular specificity is basically going to refer to the speed of the contraction, meaning that... if you're training for hypertrophy, maybe you may be going through a slower rep range, and that basically is what you're training for. And to read that actually directly, it says specific muscle contractions using different speeds and patterns to increase neuromuscular efficiency. So if you want to train for stability and control, doing slower rep ranges is going to be a type of neuromuscular specificity. If you want to train to throw something really fast, you're going to train, we'll say, for power, and you're going to do really fast or rapid contractions, and that's a different type of neuromuscular specificity. So a baseball pitcher would not train for super slow and controlled arm movements if their goal is to throw the ball faster. Obviously, for stability in the shoulder, that would make sense. So they do want to do both types to make sure that they effectively train the right muscles and have a long career, we'll say. But neuromuscular specificity does mean it's changing up the speed of the contraction for different goals. And then it says, slow and controlled stability ball dumbbell chest press increases neuromuscular efficiency and stability, basically, by adding in stability and coordination variables that aren't typically present in something like a bench press. Okay, so the more unstable an exercise is, and the slower you go, the more it focuses on stability and coordination. All right. Then we also have metabolic specificity. Metabolic specificity just solely refers to the energy it takes to perform the movement. Okay, so the energy demands placed on the body, meaning that in a overhead barbell press, you are using both arms to push a barbell overhead. That requires a certain amount of energy. Let's say you change it to a single arm overhead dumbbell press. That only uses maybe half the amount of muscle in the shoulder joint and may require less energy. So the energy demands just kind of basically like a thruster, in which you do a front squat to an overhead press with a barbell, requires a ton of energy. Therefore, that's a very specific type of metabolic work, to where single arm may be less. All right. So all three of those are basically used just to understand that what you're training for as a goal needs to be reflected in the type of movements that you're doing. So what's the mechanical specificity for stability? Well, maybe something like something less stable. What's the mechanical, or what's the specificity for, you guys hopefully get that in the sense that the neuromuscular specificity for, or the speed of the movement for stability would be slower. Okay. And then, for metabolic specificity, it's just how much energy do you want to use in this program? If you're trying to lose body fat, you probably want a higher energy demand on the body. What exercises have a higher energy demand? Well, full body exercises. If you want a lower energy demand, like something more specific for, we'll say, not to tire you out for muscle gain, you may want to just solely focus on one body part using a machine. All right, and that'll help build one muscle without tiring the rest of the muscles out. Okay, moving over to slide 6, integrated training and injuries. So just to kind of talk about a little bit about other principles associated with integrated training, the overload principle, or the principle of overload, as it sometimes is called, is basically going to be an exercise stimulus that must be done at a greater intensity than what the body is used to in order to create an adaptation or create physiological changes. So you have to exceed your current capabilities of what you're used to. And that's the principle of overload. If you do 3 sets of 10 reps of bench press all the time at the same weight, you're going to get used to that pretty easily, and there's going to be no overload after 5 weeks of doing that exact same thing. So in order to use the principle of overload, you have to do something that you're not used to. How long does it take to get used to something? Anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks, which we learned about in the general adaptation syndrome under the resistance development phase. Hopefully that kind of puts those two together and to understand how long your training program should be. All right, the variation principle. So along with you making sure that you have overload, you want to make sure that you're varying your exercises so that you're not only using, we'll say, one type of equipment to train each muscle. What that does is that creates a more, varying your type of training creates a more balanced and a more, in shape overall sort of person, meaning that if you only use a barbell for bench press and you never use dumbbells or cables, maybe you may be a lot less stable in your shoulder joint. Okay, but if you are using cables, dumbbells for chest, or for chest, body weight for chest, barbells for chest, all different types of tools, that's going to vary the adaptation, and that's going to allow for a different stimuli to take place, and will lead to better improvements of your or towards your fitness goals. And basically the way that I do that is I change up the exercise from every 4-week program to every other 4-week program. I mean that if I did bench press for chest in one program, the next program I'm going to do dumbbell bench press or incline or decline or cable or push-ups or anything like that, or kettlebell, anything. I just want to change up the exercises every program to make sure that you're always varying, which also is another form of overload. That if you vary something, it's going to change up the response needed. Therefore, it's going to create a new type of overload. All right, moving on to slide number 7, more integrated training and injuries. So low back pain and knee injuries. These are going to be the most common injuries in the world, and specifically in the nation for your clients that you will be seeing. So 80% of all U.S. adults have some form or have had some form of low back pain. And specifically, a lot of this comes from sitting down for many hours a day. Okay, so you've been sitting right there in your chair and your hip flexors have been shortening. And what that creates is a slight postural imbalance in the hip flexors, which might cause a slight low back arch or some sort of slight tweak in the low back. Over time, that's going to cause issues and pain. Okay, sitting is probably, for posture, one of the worst things that you can do. So that's why a lot of people have those stand-up desks, or they're sitting on a stability ball to where they're moving a little bit more, or they just try to every 20 minutes get out of their chair and walk around. That's what's been kind of instilled in our workplaces more frequently, because they realize that sitting is not good for you. Not only for posture, but just for health in general. All right, so next one, we have non-contact knee injuries, such as ACL tears, are really prevalent in the athletic ages. The 15 to 25 are the most athletic ages, 15 to 25, and have very strong ties with the development of arthritis in the affected knee. So, and just to kind of say that, when we say non-contact, what that means is that you're running in an open field and you decide to change direction and all of a sudden your knee buckles. That's a non-contact injury. Nobody touched you and you tore your ACL from a non-contact injury. 75% of all ACL tears are from non-contact. That's something that I do want you to know there for the test, just in case they decide to throw it on there. All right, and then it says, yeah, strong ties to developing arthritis in the knee. If you have your cartilage in the knee, that's typically going to lead to weaker cushioning, leading to potential osteoarthritis in the future. The way that you avoid ACL injuries are things like balance training, periodized fitness programs, and not doing one thing too much. If you play basketball and all you do is play basketball all the time, you're developing a slow adaptation to only do basketball. So let's say you are running an open field and you decide to cut really, really hard and you haven't really trained for that, meaning because all you've done is play basketball, that could potentially put you at risk, meaning that if you play sports, and especially if you play sports professionally, you should do other things to train your body besides just that sport. Otherwise, you're going to run into that exhaustion phase or that potential for injury, or increase that potential for injury. All right. Research suggests that enhancing neuromuscular stabilization may alleviate the high incidence of non-contact injuries. That basically just means that working on stability for 1 to 2 months out of the year, especially in the off season, is really good for athletes and just good for people in general. All right, moving on to slide 8, the OPT model. All right, so this is where NASM loves to start to really push a lot of what makes it onto the test. Not necessarily this chapter, but just the OPT model. You're going to get into this a lot further as we get into chapters maybe 11, 12, 13. But let's go over just the basics of it again. From earlier on, we kind of went over it a little bit too. So stabilization stage of training is made up of phase 1, which is called stabilization endurance. That's or phase 1 is called stabilization endurance. The main point of stabilization endurance is to introduce your clients and yourselves to stabilization training and teach them coordinated movements. Okay, so to read that, it says recruiting type 1, or basically stabilization muscle fibers, to build one's ability to maintain long-term contractions required for postural control. So controlling your posture, having that coordination, that's really what phase 1 is about. Assisting in the communication skills of your brain to your muscles. That's really what you're building in phase 1 stabilization endurance. Then in the strength stage of training, it's broken up into 3 phases. Phase 2 is strength endurance. It's basically the next step from stabilization. You start to increase a little bit of strength elements, meaning you go a little heavier weight, a few less reps. And just to read that, it says the beginning stages of creating internal tension and exerting external force, or force against an external resistance. So that's basically the definition of strength. But strength endurance, you're doing it in a way that's not, you know, going straight to a 1 to 5 rep max. You're really working on that 8 to 12, 8 to 20 rep range. That's a little heavier than what you did with stabilization endurance. But you're still building coordination, you're still building endurance, and teaching your body the skills and stability you need for further phases of training. All right, then you move into phase 3, which is a part of the strength stage, and that's going to be hypertrophy. All you need to know about hypertrophy is that you increase muscle size, okay? Increase the cross-sectional area of the muscle fiber. Get jacked, get yoked. Build those beach muscles. All right. Phase 4 is max strength, or maximal strength. And maximal strength is basically going to be defined as exerting a maximal force in a single voluntary effort. And it doesn't really matter too much about how fast that effort is, just how much weight can you move, period. So if you're doing max strength for chest, how much can you bench? Do you even lift? Okay, I'm joking. But yeah, max strength is going to really focus on just how much weight can you lift in what movement. All right, so training for max strength would be something like a power lifter would do, or maybe someone that's trying to be really strong in a sport like football. You'd want to do one effort as hard as you possibly can, as forcefully as you possibly can. That would be something like, or something that you train for max strength for. Also, max strength does have hypertrophic adaptations to it, meaning you will gain muscle if you do work in the 1 to 5 rep range or heavy weight range. Then we have the power stage of training. Power stage is consists of mainly, or yes, power stage is consists of the power phase, which is phase 5, which really focuses on the word, and you'll hear this a lot, rate of force production. So it's the ability to produce a large amount of force in a short amount of time. All right, so that's going to be the OPT model, and that's the basics behind it. There's a whole bunch of acute variables that you will learn and understand as you study this, but for now, we'll just kind of stick with that and then move on to the next slide, slide number 9. All right, next we have the integrated flexibility continuum. Integrated flexibility continuum consists of corrective flexibility, active flexibility, and functional flexibility. So what you guys need to know is what belongs in each of the corrective flexibility, active flexibility, and functional flexibility. So in corrective flexibility, in which you're basically increasing the length of tight muscles, you are going to have self-myofascial release, which is basically like foam rolling. You're using like a lacrosse ball or a hand roller to break up muscle tissue. Then along with self-myofascial release or SMR in corrective flexibility, you also have static stretching. Static stretching is a 30-second or longer hold. Typically, NASM will say 30 to 60 seconds. For me, my opinion, hold it 60 seconds or more. Typically, really allow that muscle to go to its full length of stretch and then relax and maybe do 2 to 3 sets depending on how tight the muscle is. But corrective flexibility and specifically static stretching and self-myofascial release uses the variable or basically the principle of autogenic inhibition, or uses autogenic inhibition. Autogenic inhibition is basically going to be the in which you are self-inhibiting a muscle by putting pressure on it or by stretching it. Okay, you're basically creating a tension in the muscle that tells that muscle to relax. Whether you're doing that with a foam roll or you're doing that with a static stretch, autogenic inhibition is you are inhibiting that muscle by stretching or putting tension on that muscle in the stretch characteristic. All right, next we have active flexibility, which is made up of self-myofascial release and active isolated stretching. Okay, we talked about self-myofascial release above, it's foam rolling. That's also included in all phases of the flexibility continuum. But the active isolated stretching is going to be the main one that you'll want to know. And it lasts for 2 to 5 seconds, in which you're just going to go to a point of tension. You're going to contract the antagonist muscle and then to stretch the muscle that you're trying to stretch. That is called reciprocal inhibition, in which you contract a muscle to stretch the antagonist of that muscle. So right now, as you're sitting in your chair, if you extend your leg completely forward, contracting your quad, you can feel the hamstring start to stretch. Since you're contracting your quad, which tells your hamstring to relax, that is going to be an example of reciprocal inhibition. Another way is if you extend your elbow all the way and contract your tricep, you may start to feel your bicep stretch. Okay, that's a reciprocal inhibition. And basically, with active isolated stretching, the agonist moves a limb through a full range of motion, allowing the antagonist to stretch. That's the way that I want you to think of that. All right, so that's active flexibility, and then functional flexibility is going to be made up of self-myofascial release and dynamic stretching. Okay, or basically, in my opinion, dynamic stretching is taking the body through a full range of motion in any exercise. So like taking a lunge and going nice and slow all the way full range of motion through a lunge, doing maybe a rotation with the upper body, and then coming out of that. That's a dynamic stretch in which you're just taking the body through a full range of motion. It's great for warm-ups, and that also uses reciprocal inhibition, in which you're contracting certain muscles to stretch other muscles. All right, so you do need to know that for the test, the integrated flexibility continuum and what they consist of, how long you hold each stretch, and also the principles behind it, such as autogenic inhibition or reciprocal inhibition. Memorize that. All right, moving to slide number 10, flexibility. We talk about autogenic inhibition and reciprocal inhibition. So I double hit these to make sure you guys understand it because it is very, very important. And an example of autogenic inhibition would be a sudden relaxation of a muscle upon development of high tension. That's basically, it's self-induced, and it's an inhibitory reaction that protects against a muscle tear. And specifically, the Golgi tendon organs are the receptors for that reflex. So you put pressure on a muscle on a foam roll, and that basically sends a nervous system signal through the muscle, and the Golgi tendon organ senses it and relaxes that muscle. Same thing with a static stretching. You stretch a muscle, and that muscle therefore is autogenically inhibited because it feels all that tension, and the Golgi tendon organ tells it to relax further. That's static stretching and foam rolling. That's what we talked about. Make sure you associate those with autogenic inhibition. Reciprocal inhibition associated with active isolated stretching and dynamic stretching are going to be in which the process by which muscles on one side of the joint relax or basically are inhibited to accommodate a contraction on the other side of that joint. So all joints are controlled by two opposing sets of muscles, extensors and or flexors, depending on the joint, and they must work in synchrony for smooth movement. If you're trying to contract your bicep but your tricep is not letting you, that's not really synchronized good smooth movement. That's inefficient. All right, so next we're going to get into methods for prescribing cardiorespiratory training intensity. So we're going to kind of buzz through this really quick. There is a few test questions in here, so bear with me as I get through them. But the VO2 max, so what you may have heard this before, but a VO2 max is basically going to be the ability of the body to take oxygen from the air, breathe it in through your lungs, put it in your blood, and deliver it to your muscles or deliver it to your body. The highest rate of O2 transport achieved at a maximal physical exertion is kind of the definition, meaning that the amount of oxygen that you can consume and utilize before or at maximal exertion is your VO2 max, meaning that amount of oxygen would be your VO2 max. A good VO2 for, we'll say, a athlete, like Kobe Bryant had a VO2 of around 60, and I believe that's milligrams per deciliter is the way that they measure that. But Lance Armstrong, one of the best endurance athletes in the world, had a VO2 of 80. And me, your typical average Joe, I think I was pushing like 50 to 55 as I like to surf a lot and play maybe beach volleyball. And certain sports like that allow me to have a good VO2, but not in the professional athlete range, like that 60 and or 80 for the best, one of the best athletes of all time. All right, next we have a way to calculate heart rate max. So this is the main one that I want you guys to use and know, which is 220 minus age. That's one that NASM typically asks because it's easy. So what is the method for estimating maximal heart rate? It's 220 minus age. So there is another one in the book, but I really want you to focus on 220 minus age because it's the easiest, and that's the one that NASM will typically ask about on the test. And it's not, remember, it's not a definitive heart rate max, it's just an estimate. It's your estimated heart rate max or max heart rate method. Yeah. All right, and then another way to estimate your heart rate max is through heart rate reserve. Heart rate reserve is also known as the Carbonin method. They may refer to it on the test in either way. But basically the difference between one's predicted max heart rate and his or her resting heart rate determines the or target heart rate. So basically the formula is going to be heart rate max minus heart rate at rest times the desired intensity, and then you add back in the heart rate at rest. I want you to calculate both your 220 minus age or your max heart rate method and then your heart rate reserve just to see the differences. In my opinion, the heart rate reserve is just a little bit too much math for someone to do on the spot to determine some heart rate ranges. The whole point you need to know someone's max heart rate is to determine, as we move to the next slide, and actually it's further, but basically to determine the cardiorespiratory training stages. Okay, that's why you need to have someone's heart rate max, because a percentage of someone's heart rate max is going to be a cardiorespiratory training stage. Yeah, perfect. All right, so let's move on to slide number 12. Another method for prescribing cardiorespiratory intensity. First one we're going to talk about is the RPE scale, or they also call it the Borg scale. Rate of perceived exertion is RPE. It's a 6 to 20 scale, which is a rating on how hard the work is. A rating of 12 to 13 is your typical anaerobic threshold. Sometimes NASM likes to ask at which point of the RPE scale is there a switchover from oxidative to anaerobic metabolism, or aerobic to anaerobic, and it's around 12 to 13, but so we included that there just in case they do decide to throw that at you. But yeah, the Borg scale, the Mr. Borg just wanted to be kind of mean and create a 6 to 20 scale. Nobody really uses 6 to 20. Most people use 1 to 10. So if you can see in this picture below, we have the 6 to 20 scale in conjunction with the modified Borg scale, or the modified 0 or 1 to 10 scale, which is how hard does it feel right now? On a scale of 1 to 10, how hard are you working? I typically go with the 1 to 10 because that's just easier. Oh, it's like a 5. I could go harder, but it's not too bad. But oh, this is a 9. I'm almost dying. It's very, very difficult. All right. So the next thing we're going to get into what I was talking before on the slide. I missed the talk test on the last one. The talk test is also important to know. That's on back to slide 12. The talk test is the point at which one cannot carry on a simple conversation or basically complete a longer sentence without taking a breath, because they're breathing too hard. The example I always give is, I'm going to the store to get bananas. And that's saying it when you pass the talk test. If you're failing the talk test, you're saying, I'm going to the store to get bananas. Okay, that's failing the talk test. You've probably heard that more than once whenever we talk about that, but that is the way that you would explain the talk test. All right, so next we have the cardiorespiratory training zones. NASM loves to talk about the cardiorespiratory training zones. Why? Because you, as a personal trainer, will prescribe cardiorespiratory training, or you will program cardiorespiratory training for your clients. Zone 1, cardiorespiratory training, 65 to 75% of heart rate max. That is going to basically, you're going to take someone's max heart rate, multiply it by 65% and 75%, or 0.65 and 0.75, to determine their zone 1 training. Okay, this is why we use the 220 minus age to get their heart rate max, and then you take it 65% of that and 75% of that, and that's their range for zone 1. It's basically your base zone, building a base, or it can't even be your recovery zone, just a basic cardiorespiratory training area, nice and easy. Not too out of control. A lot of really out of shape people, though, will struggle with this for sure. All right, next is going to be zone 2, 76 to 85% of heart rate max. Anaerobic threshold is where this is, or that's in what zone is the anaerobic threshold kind of hit. That's definitely zone 2, that's 65 to 75%. And this in the anaerobic threshold is the point at which the body can no longer produce enough energy for working muscles through aerobic work, or through the oxidative system, or aerobic glycolysis, so therefore must tap into the anaerobic system or move to anaerobic glycolysis. All right, so that's zone 2. 220 minus age times 76 to 85% is going to give you a range for zone 2. Someone that's in better shape should be moving into zone 2. And then you have zone 3, which is 90% or more. Or NASA may say 86 to 95. We just say, yeah, 90% or more, or even 86 to 90% sometimes NASM will go with, but anything above 85% is just considered zone 3. That's the way we'll say it. And it's basically your peak exertion. It's your maximal exertion, maximal effort. And typically you can't last in zone 3 longer than 30 to 60 seconds. And you really don't need to hit this too often through the week. 1 to 2 times per week is great, and that's even for someone that is a professional athlete. Even though their sport may require more zone 3 work, therefore you should train a little bit more zone 3. But that's training athletes, and this NASM typically in this certified personal training program focuses on the normal average client. All right, so moving to slide 14, two-thirds of the way through, guys, almost done. Bear with me as we get through core training. So, function of the core is to ensure optimal functioning and movement efficiency of basically the spine, and really it's to stabilize the spine. And that second one says muscles of the core need to work together to promote spinal stability. The most important thing in the body is going to be brain, spinal cord, and heart. All of those are very protected. Well, specifically the core protects the spinal cord, and the skull obviously protects the brain, but and the heart is protected by the rib cage. But the most, in order to avoid pain, the core needs to be trained to work together to promote spinal stability. The first exercise that you should learn in core training is the draw-in maneuver, or the drawing-in maneuver, they may call it. It's basically in which you suck your belly button towards your spine and allow for the neutral spine or neutral pelvis to be had, but using muscles to promote that. So in your chair right now, sucking your spine towards your navel and holding that, most people have to hold their breath at first to contract that. But your goal is to be able to do it with breathing through and locking that in. It takes some training. It takes anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to really get it down, maybe even 4 weeks. But once you get it down, it's really important to start to do every exercise with this drawing and maneuver to promote a neutral pelvis and a neutral lumbar spine, because you don't want to have put yourself at risk for injury. But the draw maneuver is used to prevent the anterior pelvic tilt. So if you ever have that question on the test, the anterior pelvic tilt means you're arching the low back. The drawing and maneuver kind of neutralizes that arch. It also helps to activate the inner unit of the core, meaning the pelvic floor muscles, the diaphragm, transverse abdominis, internal oblique, and multifidus, which creates that spinal stability. And the way that you do it is basically by drawing in the navel towards the spine and locking it in. Guys, you could practice 10 seconds at a time. You practice 30 seconds at a time. Whatever you can get, practicing that is very, very important. And I only realized that because I did injure my back from having a slight anterior pelvic tilt. Even though it wasn't noticeable in my overhead squat assessment, I still had it because I had tight hip flexors because I was sitting down too much, and ended up during a deadlift injuring my back, in which I had to go back and learn all that really, or really learn how to do the draw maneuver correctly and use it during all of my exercises now. All right, and then abdominal bracing is another form to contract the core. You may see it in this textbook, you may not, but the NASM sometimes talks about abdominal bracing, so we included it. It's basically going to be what I consider it is the athletic position, in which you have the knees bent, your hips in neutral position, your glutes are contracted, you're kind of pressing out, squeezing your core, and your shoulder blades are rotated back and down, meaning retracted and depressed. And locking that position in there just kind of braces the entire core and sets you up for to be really, really stable or be able to react really quick like an athletic position does. Cool. So let's move over to slide 15, balance training. So balance, just to define it, is the ability to maintain an upright position without falling over. And that's going to develop neuromuscular efficiency within your movements. There's two types of balance. There's static balance, which is balancing with no movement, meaning you're in one place and you're balancing on 1 foot, 2 feet, whatever it may be, sitting, you're not moving. Dynamic balance is going to be you're moving and you must stay upright and you must stay level, we'll say. And you could also change direction, but you must stay level. Falling over is like, let's say you're running really hard and you cut and you or you get juked in with someone playing basketball. You're moving, and that's dynamic balance. And if you fall over, that's you've lost your dynamic balance, or you fell because you lost dynamic balance. All right. So another thing that is commonly associated with balance training is proprioception and training in proprioceptively enriched environments. What does proprioception mean? It basically means the sum of all sensory input of basically the positioning of all body limbs and all the input that you get of your body position from your sensory nervous system. And another way to describe the proprioceptively enriched environments is a unstable but controllable. It's like standing on a balance beam or standing on a balance pad or using a BOSU ball. It's not uncontrollable like some people on a unicycle, if you haven't figured that out, it's not controllable for them. They cannot balance in any way. But yeah, over time you can make that controllable, but I guess that wasn't the greatest example, but we'll use it. All right, intermuscular coordination. is going to be another definition we're going to go over. Intermuscular coordination is basically the communication between different muscle groups with the nervous system. Or to read it, it's the ability of the neuromuscular system to coordinate appropriate contractions and movements between different muscle groups to achieve a common goal or to achieve a common movement pattern. That's multiple muscles working together. Okay. Then you also have your intramuscular coordination. Notice the difference. Inter means within many muscle groups. Intra means within one muscle, and that's the muscle fibers. Intramuscular coordination basically refers to the ability of the neuromuscular system to allow optimal levels of motor unit recruitment and synchronization within one muscle, or within a muscle, which results in greater force production and control of that one muscle, or injury prevention. Moving over to slide 16, a few more balanced terms. Sensory motor control. This is basically the muscular system, the peripheral nervous system, and the central nervous system working together to obtain balance and postural control. It's basically just referring to the communication between your sensory system, your brain, and your motor system to properly control your body. Postural stability, probably pretty simple and you get that one. The ability to prepare, maintain, anticipate, and restore stability of the entire human movement system. And mainly it's having great stability with proper posture, I guess is another way that I'd describe that. And then joint stability is the ability to prepare, maintain, anticipate, and restore stability at each joint, meaning that you are you don't have a muscle imbalance at a joint. Your muscles are balanced, and therefore that creates optimized stability. Then we have the sensory motor integration. Sensory motor integration is going to be the ability of the nervous system to gather and interpret info to anticipate and execute a proper motor response. So that's kind of with that sensory motor control. That integration is to really focus on that proper motor response based off of your sensory surroundings. All right, so next we're going to move into reactive training and the reactive training terms. First one we're going to talk about, which we talked about a little bit earlier, rate of force production. How fast can you contract the muscle with the maximum amount of force? Kind of like power, and reactive training is basically power-based training. It's plyometric training. And then also motor unit recruitment. The more motor units you recruit, the more power you can produce. Activation of motor units is in a successive manner to produce more force or more strength. Those are direct adaptations of plyometric training or of reactive training, are those two right there. There's an example pictured there of a reactive training exercise, which is just basically a box jump in which you're trying to jump as high as you can to then land on the box. That explosive sort of jumping and reacting to jump is going to be a key component of reactive training. Furthermore, as we move into slide 18, reactive training. So reactive training is going to also focus on firing frequency. So along with the motor unit recruitment and collection together of motor unit recruitment, recruiting all the muscle fibers, you also want those muscle fibers to fire as frequently as possible and as much as possible. That means that also integrates more power and more strength. And continued force. So the number of activation signals sent to a motor unit in 1 second. That's basically the brain sending continuous signals to contract as hard as you can, as frequently as possible in that 1 second. Next, we have the integrated performance paradigm, which is basically just another word for, in reactive training, it's another word for the stretch shortening cycle. What is the stretch shortening cycle? It's the point of you're going to stretch the muscle and then shorten it and create an elastic response out of that muscle in order to basically create an ability to jump higher. So the force cycle, a force cycle of a muscle contraction that involves an eccentric loading of the muscle followed immediately by a concentric unloading of a muscle. And what that basically means is just that you are eccentrically loading, meaning you're stretching, you're lengthening a muscle, and then you immediately push that into a concentric loading of that muscle. So then we have the amortization phase. Amortization phase is going to be the point in between the eccentric loading and the concentric unloading. That's basically you're at the bottom of a squat and transitioning into that jump. Okay. You lowered, and then the amortization phase is that transition, and then you're jumping as high as you can. So to read it, it says the second phase of the stretch shortening cycle, and it's a short, almost non-noticeable transition from eccentric to concentric. It's that in between the lengthening to the shortening of the muscle. So those three are basically the stretch shortening cycle, or the phases of plyometric training, or the plyometric training or plyometric contraction. All right, moving over to slide number 19, we have a SAQ. We're going to be getting and talking quickly about SAQ. SAQ is directly related to speed, or it stands for speed, agility, and quickness. Speed is going to be straight ahead velocity, meaning running straight ahead. Speed in humans is measured by stride rate times stride length, meaning stride rate is the number of steps in a given amount of time. And then the stride length is going to be the distance covered with each step or with each stride. When you multiply those together, if you're doing 3 feet and 10 steps, that's going to be 30 feet. Okay. Or 3 feet per step and 10 steps, that's 30 feet. All right, so next we have the agility. Agility is going to be changing direction at various speeds, or basically agility, in my opinion, is going to be changing directions while maintaining proper posture and kind of changing directions efficiently and quickly. All right, and then you have quickness, which is basically going to be the reaction to a stimulus. So when you see something coming at you, like a pitcher throws a ball and you're at bat, you're in baseball, and you react really quickly to find out where that ball is going to be to hit it, that's quickness. Sports that are really good at quickness are things like baseball, like boxing, we'll say fighting in general, any sort of fighting. Basically to read that, it's reacting to a stimulus with an appropriate muscular response without hesitation or quickly. All right, next we're going to get into resistance training modalities, and specifically we're going to get into the types of systems or resistance training systems used in the gym. So we'll go over these kind of quick. A single set system is going to be one set of each exercise. So basically one set, 12 reps maybe, and you're out. Single set system is great for older people that haven't trained in a long time, or really, really out of shape people that might get sore and get a complete workout from one set. A multiple set system is just that. It's more than one set. Warm-up sets, or basically more than one set of an exercise. So 2, 3, 4, however many it may be. Next, we have a pyramid system. That pyramid system is going to basically be increasing or decreasing in weight, more or less. And that's directly in an inverse relationship to the amount of reps that you can perform. For instance, if you're going from light to heavy, you start with light weights and high reps, and you're working up to high weight and low reps. And then if you're working heavy to light, you start with high weight and low reps, and you work up to low weight and high reps, or I guess you would work down from high reps or high weight to low weight, whichever way you want to think about that. Next, we have the circuit training system. Circuit training is performing one exercise after the other with minimal rests. Okay, you do like a complete five circuit exercise system, take a rest, and then you complete that again. So minimal rest. That's typically the way I do it. Circuit training is great for getting people's heart rate up. A great way to introduce any form or any new client is just going through a circuit, and really helps people get the basics. Yeah, I love doing circuit training for the phase 1, phase 2 clients that I have. All right, or new clients. Next one, as we move over to slide number 21, we have the peripheral heart action system. Peripheral heart action system is going to be great for the elderly population because it alternates between upper and lower body exercises in a circuit that basically gets the heart rate pumping really, really fast. It's you don't have to go crazy with the peripheral heart action system, but a few chair squats to a few chest presses, alternating is going to be a PHA circuit and really gets the heart rate up because the heart has to pump blood from lower body to upper body, then back to lower body, then back to upper body in a circuit. Really tough for the heart to do, but really good for getting someone a great workout in a short amount of time. And also great for elderly clients because it helps strengthen their heart muscle. Next, we have a tri-set system. Tri-set system is three exercises of the same body part without rest. Okay, That's the main thing. It's kind of like a supersetting with three, but it's we call it a tri-set. And then you also have a split routine system, which is what is most common in fitness, which is in which you split up the body parts into different days so you can achieve a certain amount of volume within each body part. An example of that would be on Monday, you're doing chest and back. On Wednesday, you're doing your legs. And on Friday, you're doing shoulders and your arms. That hits most body parts. And then you can include core somewhere in there, or do core on all days, or do cardio on all days, your choice. So split routine just kind of breaks it up. Really great for gaining muscle, and just great in general for optimizing lots of different fitness goals. All right, so we hit all those pretty long. There's a lot of important information in there. That's why there's going to be a lot of assignments for this chapter. A decent amount of stuff that makes it onto the test. So make sure you complete the assignment, listen to the audiobook lecture below, and then also we want you to listen to the assignment audio and then take the quiz at the bottom. That will set you up to be most successful in this chapter and on the test once you take it. Thanks for hanging out with me, guys, and I look forward to seeing you down below in the audio lecture. Cheers.